The key to guaranteed disappointment in life is wrong expectations. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
1980, actually it was at the time that Mount St. Helens blew. I'm talking about the day. I was on my way to South Korea. We went on a USO tour. You know, like Bob Hope. Everybody remember Bob Hope? I guess I got to update my references one of these days. Anyway, we'll see. Bob Hope was this comedian. For you that are, you know, under the age of, I don't know, 60. Anyway, we're on our way to South Korea, and, you know, we were fired up. We were going to be gone for 9 weeks with this bunch of musicians. And when we got to South Korea, they took us to this 5-star hotel. Now, we really hadn't thought about where we'd be staying, but they took us to this hotel. It was, well, it looked nice on the outside. And, you know, for the most part, it was nice. There was a couple of glitches, you know, like, for example, the shower, which was just a little more than a trickle, would change at random from scalding hot to freezing cold. Turns out it was hooked up to the dishwasher in the kitchen. So every time they'd hit the dishwasher, you'd, and then you'd readjust it, and the dishwasher would stop, and you'd, you know, be scalded. And the other downside was that our room, the room that the keyboard player and I shared, was faced the courtyard of the local, I guess it was the equivalent of the National Guard. It wasn't the Army, and it wasn't the police department. It was this kind of National Guard type thing. And every morning at 6 o'clock, they would stand out in this courtyard and do, you know, calisthenics and you know, very loud, and they would all count in unison, you know, uno, dos, tres, whatever Korean is. I can't do it. We came to recognize it, but we never learned to speak it. So, but except for the, you know, the scalding, freezing water and the automatic alarm clock 7 days a week at 6 in the morning, it was a pretty nice place, actually. And we kind of got used to it. We were there for 2 weeks in South Korea, getting a bus every day, and we'd go from one end of the country. We went up to Panmunjom, the DMZ, and then we'd go down to Pusan in the South Shore, and we'd, you know, come back home every night to this hotel. So that was pretty nice for the first 2 weeks. And then it's time for us to ship out. Our time in Korea was done, and we were moving on to, actually, we'd agreed to go into the Persian Gulf to visit the fleet. This was when, now, May 1980. This is when the hostages had just been taken in Iran, and the rescue attempt had just failed earlier in May. And there were lots and lots of sailors and soldiers and Marines and Air Force people out in the Persian Gulf. And they asked us if we, you know, wanted to take a little detour from our itinerary. And we said, sure, we'll do that. I mean, you know, these guys and gals are stuck out there for who knows how long. What at least we can do is pay a little visit. So we set course for Oman. And from Oman, we flew to Diego Garcia. Diego Garcia is a horseshoe-shaped island in the middle of nowhere. Has no native culture whatsoever. It's actually a British, how do they say that? British island territory, something like that. The Brits own it anyway. And so if one of the native roosters were to crow under your bed, because the houses are built up on stilts, and you happen to strangle one of those roosters, that's a British subject, and you can go to prison in Hong Kong. Not where you want to go, you know. So we're on Diego Garcia, and we get off the plane, and they say, we're going to take you to your, you know, your billet, your lodging. We go, great, you know, I could use a shower and some TV time. Think again. We showed up. They drove us around the corner, and there before us was several rows of Quonset huts. And inside the Quonset huts were rows and rows of army cots. I mean, just your basic, you know, scissor leg thing with a piece of canvas. And then a pillow. No pillowcase, no sheet, no blanket, just a cot, because it's 115 degrees, who needs a blanket? And I remember we all sat down and kind of looked at each other and said, can you believe this mess? How dare they? We're guests. We've sacrificed our time and our summer to come over here and just, you know, entertain these folks. And they put us in this thing and we were grumbling and griping and complaining. Now, here's my point. If they had told us, look, when you get to Diego Garcia, it's going to be kind of like camping out, we would have gone, oh, cool. We're into camping out. You know, can you fish there? You know, is there stuff to do? But instead, we were expecting another five-star hotel kind of accommodation. And so to say that we were disappointed is probably the understatement of the world. The key to disappointment is wrong expectations. Now, the same is true when it comes to life in the Lord. Now, if you don't know what to expect, if you just kind of enter into the thing, you know, ready for anything and open to whatever the Lord wants to do, it really is just one great surprise after another. But if you bring certain expectations into that relationship, you are sure to be disappointed. Take the whole idea of wealth, for example. There are those who would expect and those that would actually teach you that the minute you enter into a relationship with God through faith in Jesus Christ, that all of your financial struggles are just going to go out the window like yesterday's news. They expect the Lord to solve all their financial problems, to make them, if not rich, at the very least comfortable and secure, you know. But the fact is that even though there are godly financial principles in the Word, you know, stuff like saving and avoiding debt and giving that can and will improve your financial situation, there's nowhere in the Word does God guarantee that your financial cup is going to runneth over. It's just not in there. And so if that's what you're expecting, man, are you going to be disappointed? Take the concept of health. It's kind of the same thing. There are those that would teach that the minute you come to faith in Christ, that every pain and ache and illness is just going to go away because by His stripes you are healed. Well, you know, the fact is we are healed by His stripes. It's just not that kind of a healing. You know, even though there are godly principles to follow when it comes to our health, you know, the whole Jewish dietary law. I don't think we're under the law to have to eat kosher, but it just, you know, coincidentally turns out that kosher is about the healthiest diet that there is. What you eat and what you don't eat, you know, and exercise. And there are certain basics that the Word talks about that if you follow those, you know, you're going to do well. But the truth is that injury and disease are just part of life on this fallen, sin-infected planet. And if you expect otherwise, you set yourself up for great disappointment. Now, it follows then that the way to avoid disappointment is to have right expectations. And when it comes to following Jesus, He's given us the information we need to have right expectations. You might even call them great expectations, if I can borrow that from whoever that was, Dickens or one of those guys. Who's got a degree in literature? Tell me who wrote that. Okay, there you go. Yeah, good guess, huh? I knew it all along, Bob. Just testing you. So, let's start reading in verse 32 of Mark 10, and we'll work our way through this next passage. Mark 10, verse 32 says, now they were on the road going up to Jerusalem. Now remember, we just had that encounter with the rich young ruler. Good master, what must I do? You know, Jesus says, well, do this, 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 and this. He says, got it, done. You know, got it covered. And Jesus said, well, how about this one other thing? Hit the guy right in the heart, right where he lived, and he couldn't do it. It says he walked away sad. Now, while they're on their way, going up to Jerusalem, and you know, no matter where you are, Jerusalem is up. Jerusalem's at the top of the hill. So it doesn't matter if you're north, south, east, or west, you're going up. And Jesus was going before them, you know, kind of leading the march. And they were amazed. And as they followed, they were afraid. And then he took the 12 aside again and began to tell them the things that would happen to him. "Behold," he said, "we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. And they'll mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him. In the third day, he'll rise again." Okay, in these two verses, Jesus tells the 12 what to expect in the coming days. Look again at the first verse. "Now they were on the road going to Jerusalem, and Jesus was going before them." It says, "And they were amazed. And as they followed, they were afraid." They were amazed and afraid at the same time. You know, following Jesus can be an amazing and frightening thing. That's just the reality of it. They were amazed, it tells us, at his determination. Now, we're going to see in a minute that they didn't really get, even now, the big picture, where he was going, what was going to happen. But still, they were amazed at his courage. I mean, they had been, you know, out of the territory for a while because of death threats against him. And now, as he entered back in and came down from Caesarea Philippi to Capernaum and, you know, kind of around the horn on his way to Jerusalem, headed south, he was fearless. Now, he knew full well, he had told them, you know, "I have to walk, you know, while it's light. You have to keep walking." And they were just amazed at that. At the same time, they were also afraid because they understood as well as he did, or, you know, about the threats, the very real death threats against him. The religious leaders were openly out to get him. And everybody knew that. And amazed and afraid. What a strange mix of emotions, isn't it? I mean, but maybe you've been there. To be totally amazed at following the Lord and at the same time just scared to death about where he's taking you, where he seems to be taking you. I think that's a healthy thing. It kind of exercises our faith, don't you think? Or our trust. I mean, this looks scary to me. What do you mean, jump? Yeah, it's okay. If he says jump, you can jump. You know, if he says let's go, you can go. If he says stay put, you can stay put. The key there is to keep following him. You may be amazed, you may be afraid, just keep following. That's what they're going to do here. Now, the last part of verse 32 says he took the 12 aside, okay, the apostles. Realize this sort of hierarchy. Jesus, of course, had his inner circle of James, John, and Peter. They're the three that accompanied up to the top of the mountain by Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus was transfigured. You remember that from a few weeks ago. There were the three. Then there were the 12, the apostles, you know, the ones that he had called, "Come follow me and I'll make you fishers of men," and "Leave that tax collector's booth," and, "Oh, you know, can anything good, you know, come out of Nazareth? Yeah, Andrew, I think I got your number, and come with me." And there's the 12. And then there's the sort of larger crowd of followers. There was his mom, you know, Mary, and we learned that eventually his other brothers and sisters were part of that crowd. Now, sometimes they were part of that crowd trying to get him out of there. He's lost his mind, but they were there. His mother had a sister, Salome. She was in that bunch. Mary Magdalene was in that group. And some would say there were 100 or so followers in that larger entourage. And then beyond that, of course, there were hundreds and hundreds more that would just follow him to see what's he going to do now. And as he had left the territory, you know, for a while, for a season, went to Tyre and Sidon and up north there, and then came back down to Capernaum, headquarters, word got around all through the Decapolis, the 10 cities on that east side of the Sea of Galilee and Jordan River. And you can just imagine there are throngs and throngs, and they may come and they may go, and there's kind of an ebb and flow to it, but there's a whole lot of folks. And he calls in the 12, you know, his closest companions. He took them aside and began to tell them the things that were going to happen. Now, this is the third time that Jesus has told them what to expect. The first in Mark. The first one we read about in chapter 8, verse 31. The second time was chapter 9, verse 31. Nice of the Lord to make those both verse 31, so they're easy to remember. But now we get to 10, and it's verse 33, actually, where he begins this. But it's not the first time he's told them. Now, turn real quickly up one book to Luke, chapter 18. And this is Luke's account of the very same event. You know, in Luke 18, at verse 18, we have the rich young ruler. And then in verse 24, we have the all things are possible, easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle in that business. And then when we get to verse 31, he says, you know, behold, he took the 12 aside and said, behold, we're going up to Jerusalem, and all things that are written by the prophets concerning the Son of Man will be accomplished. He'll be delivered to the Gentiles and be mocked and insulted and spit upon. They'll scourge him and kill him, and on the third day he'll rise again. Here it is in verse 34. They understood none of these things. The saying was hidden from them, and they didn't know the things which were spoken. It's like he kept saying the same thing, and they just, I mean, it couldn't mean what it seems to mean. You know, it's kind of like we read, you know, in the Ten Commandments, you know, thou shalt not lie. You mean never? Really? He can't mean that. Yeah, that's what it means. And he said the Son of Man is going to go up three times, he told him. Three times that are recorded. Three, probably more than that. I'm going to go, they're going to arrest me, torture me, humiliate me, shame me, kill me. And 3 days later, I'll rise up again, and they still don't get it. They didn't get it. They didn't want to get it. It just didn't make sense with their assumptions. They weren't expecting that. And so they never really considered the possibility that he might actually have meant what he said. Now, this is the third time he told them. It's the first time that he told them where. Verse 33, behold, we're going up to Jerusalem. Now, they're still on their way to Jerusalem. We'll read a little further down the road, we see when Jesus comes to Jericho. And Jericho is at the foot of the hill where the road up to Jerusalem starts. So they aren't going up that hill yet. So at this point, it wouldn't be obvious where their destination is. Once you get past Jericho and head up the hill, it's like a 25-mile hill where it changes almost a mile in elevation. You go from about 1,200 feet below sea level to like 2,500 feet above sea level. It's all uphill. It's all switchbacks. If you've ever taken that trip over there and the bus driver takes you up there, it's like, you know, you look out the window and you're thinking, this guy's going to drive us off the side of the road. It never happens. I don't know why. I guess God's looking out for him. But it's a scary thing, you know. But they're on their way to Jerusalem, but that's not obvious yet. And so he tells them, you know, behold, fellas, this is what's going to happen. We're going to go up to Jerusalem where the Son of Man will be betrayed and so forth and so on. He tells them for the first time, Jerusalem. Now, see, they didn't expect anything bad to happen in Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the holy city. You know, the temple of God. You know, yeah, the Romans are there. There's this political kind of nonsense going on, but surely we can rise above that. And, you know, but you know, in Jerusalem, nothing bad can happen. Maybe they thought they'd ambush him, you know. He'd come around a blind corner, or they'd come out from behind a rock or something and get him in the middle of the night. Not in Jerusalem, but that's what he tells them. We're going to Jerusalem. It's the first time he'd ever told them where. It's also the first time he included that part about the Gentiles. The Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. They never expected him to be handed over to the Gentiles. You know, maybe they expected that. Well, they knew there was this plot against him. There were certain of the religious leaders, you know, scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, et cetera. And they were, and you know, they, who knows what they were thinking. Maybe they'll, you know, they'll ambush him like we said a minute ago. But the idea that they would so reject him that they would actually turn him over to the Gentiles. This was unthinkable. It was the last thing they expected. No one ever would have thought up that twist to the plot, but he tells them about it now. You know, maybe they were thinking that the priests would eventually come around. You know, a lot of folks will theorize that that kind of was the deal with Judas. That Judas felt that if he only, you know, sort of put Jesus' feet to the fire and had him arrested and he'd stand before the high priest and then he'd do a miracle. He'd make somebody float or levitate or disappear, or he'd heal, cleanse a leper or heal a blind man. And then if he did it right in front of them, then they'd have to say, oh, he is the Messiah, you know, and everything would change. Maybe they were kind of expecting that to happen, but that the leadership, the high priest and the Sanhedrin, that council of 70, that they would reject him wholly and condemn him and actually hand him over to the Romans, that's the last thing anybody expected. But he's telling them pretty clearly, you know, what they ought to expect. Now, all three times that Jesus predicted or prophesied what was going to happen to him, he told them to expect the resurrection. Verse 34, they'll mock him and scourge him and spit on him. Notice he spends a lot of time talking about just the humiliation and shame of the whole process. Spit on him and mock him and kill him. And the third day, he'll rise again. He told them plainly, but still, after his death, they spent the first 3 days mourning and hiding. When they could have been spent those 3 days excited, waiting, and watching. He told them what to expect, but they just didn't seem to get it. I think the lesson for us here is to pay close attention to the words of the Lord. He's going to tell us what to expect. He's told us that he's with us. He's told us that he's in us. He's told us that he'll never leave us or forsake us. He's shown us that he loves us and that he died for us. We know that he's got an important job, a function in the body for each one of us. And we also know that he's coming for us. He's told us exactly what to expect. None of that should surprise us. We know what to expect because he told us. Now, in the next six verses, James and John tell Jesus what they expect. Look at verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, you know, also known as the sons of thunder. Lord, shall we call down fire? No, guys, chill out. They came to him and they said, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Have your kids ever done that? Mom, I want you to give me anything I ask for. You know, first thing you do is go, okay, the radar comes up. This isn't good. This can't be good. You know, what's up? And that's what he says. What do you want me to do for you? You know, I think he kind of said it with that. You know, what's cooking here, guys? And they said, grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory. You know, it's as if they hadn't heard what he just said. I'm going to Jerusalem to be condemned, humiliated, and tortured to death. And they were so caught up in their own expectations that they weren't even listening to what he said. They missed it altogether. And that's what we do. We get so involved in our own, you know, fantasy of the way that we want things to go or the way that we wish things would go. Even when it comes to following the Lord, we get so caught up in our own imagination of even what that is or what that means that we stop listening to him. I've seen ministry after ministry. Now, I don't know. When do you consider yourself an old timer? I don't consider myself an old timer in the ministry, but it's been over 20 years. I've watched ministries and ministers rise and crash. And it's just scary. Just last week, I got the phone call. A good guy who's a good friend of mine in the ministry crashed. he crashed and he burned, and now, you know, he doesn't have a ministry anymore, and his church is floundering. You know, the sheep don't have a shepherd, and they're kind of freaking out, and you know, his family is involved. What's up with this? And it's just not pretty. And I realize, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, or there go you and I. But we'll see what happens is for a minute, it just takes a minute, and it's just one time, you know. He let his own ideas and his own thoughts about what the Lord would consider good for him overshadow what the Lord actually said would be good for him. And the next thing you know, there's a crisis. Now there's restoration, there's healing, there's forgiveness. No question about that. But man, are there going to be scars? And damage has been done that can't be undone. And that's kind of what's going on here. These guys just got so caught up in their own, what I want what I want, when I want it, the way I want it, how I want it, that they just didn't even hear him when he told them what to expect. And they said, well, this is what we're expecting. You know, Matthew in chapter 20 gives us the sort of another key piece of information. Their mom was in on this. Actually, in Matthew, it says it's their mother that comes to Jesus. I'd like you, with the boys, you know, come on, grabs them by the ear. These guys were in their 30s and 40s, you know, I'm going to grab you by the ear and now tell him. No, you tell him. No, I don't want to tell him. No, you tell him, you know, okay, here's what we want. Will you do anything we ask? You said whatever we ask in your name, you know, ha, ha, gotcha, loophole. You know, mom says it's okay, you know, it's got to be all right kind of a thing. These guys, they thought they knew what they were asking. You know, verse 38, Jesus tells them, you do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? Now, these are figures of speech. Don't let anyone try to convince you that he's talking about cups and baptisms here. You know, he's saying, can you go through what I'm going to go through? I mean, they don't realize that's what they're asking, but that is what they're asking. What they're asking is, they're asking, can we die for the gospel? They don't realize that, but that's what he knows. You don't realize what you ask. Can you go through what I'm going to go through? And they say, sure, no problem. Look at the progression in this little conversation. First, Jesus tells them, you don't know what you're asking. And they think, well, yeah, you know, sure we do. Yeah. And he says, well, do you think you can go through what I'm going to go through? Yeah, no problem. You know, I guess what I'm learning there is don't be too quick to answer. You know, when the Lord is bringing something to your attention, what he's really telling them here is consider what you're asking. It's not a yes or no question, even though it's posed as a yes or no question. Its intent is to make us think, to make them think. You know, do you guys really know? You think about this. What you know, you're going to go through what I'm going to go through? You know, when Jesus says you don't know what you ask, the correct answer is tell me more. Not, yeah, sure. You know, well, Lord, what do you mean by that? You know, what do you mean be careful? What is there to be careful about? Well, let the Lord tell you. You know, Jesus knew what they were asking, even though they didn't. They were asking to die for the gospel. And Jesus said, you will go through the baptism I go and drink the cup I drink, but just not right now. James, as it turns out, would be the first apostle to die because of the gospel in Jerusalem. He was the first one. The Romans beheaded him, if I remember right. You're one of those? Okay, off with his head. James, the brother of John, not to be confused with James, the brother of Jesus, who lived to lead that church in Jerusalem. John, the other brother, was the last apostle to die for the gospel. They ran him around, and he traveled a bunch. Some say he went even to to Great Britain, what we know as Great Britain, and traveled quite a bit and shared the gospel and taught and, you know, did that apostle thing. And finally the Romans said, okay, you're done. And they locked him up, and then they were going to kill him. They tried to boil him in oil, but he didn't boil. I mean, I don't know. He's kind of like Daniel in the lion's den. The oil was boiling, and they dunked him down in the tank, and he just kind of came out. You know, I guess he was just a tough turkey, and he wasn't gonna go. And so finally, they did the only thing they could do. They exiled him to the island of Patmos. You know, if we can't kill you, so we're just gonna kind of hide you. We're gonna put you away where you can't do any harm. So what does he do? He writes the Gospel of John, and has that experience that leads to the Book of Revelation. Lord, we want, you know, we know what we're asking for. Oh, do you really? Well, you know, you are going to go through it, but not the way you think. And Jesus' answer to them, verse 40. But to sit on my right hand and on my left, that's what they wanted, the places of honor when he came into his glory, is not mine to give, but it's for those for whom it is prepared. Even here we see Jesus in perfect submission to the Father. Not my will, but your will be done. Now the lesson for us in these verses is to never let our expectations, our dreams, our desires, our wants, our wishes, never let them overshadow or drown out the word of the Lord. See, he told them what to expect, but it just went in one ear and out the other, and they came right back at him, with their own expectations. It's so easy, even when you're close to the Lord, and they obviously were. This is the disciple that Jesus loved, right? John. It's so easy, even when you're close to the Lord, to let our ideas keep us from seeing and understanding his ideas. That's why you got to stay close to the Word. I remember being in La Center, early 1990s. We started a little Bible study up there, and it grew. And then we went to the Grange Hall, and then we moved to the school. And we finally wound up in this place called the Wheel Club, just a little community center. It was about like our downstairs fellowship hall. It had a main room, and it had a kitchen and a couple of restrooms, and that was it. There was a closet, but they kept it locked because it was also the evidence room for the La Center Police Department. Pretty secure, you know. It's like, oh, you can't go in there. We got all of our pot and coke and stuff stashed in there for when these cases come to trial. Okay. Anyway, we met there for 6 years. Little community center, little place. And then we started out, it was, you know, there's just a few folks, 20 folks, and we kind of 30 and 40 and 50, and then there were 60 coming, and we were having to get extra chairs and put them up, and it was pretty neat. And I remember one day there was a new family to the church, kind of like here. There's new people were coming all the time. It was really starting to grow, really starting to take off. And I remember a guy asked me, well, when are you going to build a church? And I knew what he meant. When you're going to put up your own church building instead of meeting in this little, what was now a cramped little community building. I can't take credit for it. The Lord just kind of, you know, it was one of those, don't worry about what to say, I'll give you what to say. And the Lord just kind of spoke through me, and he said, I said, the Lord is building a church here. And then when he wants to put a roof over it, he will. See, the Lord was building a church. But it would have been so easy, especially for me, you know, to go, ooh, yeah, you know, sanctuary, offices, library, you know, espresso bar. You know, I mean, it wouldn't take too much dreaming at all for me to come up with a great vision for a great facility and start having, you know, fundraising and the thermometers on the wall with, you know, and all that stuff. But praise the Lord, he protected me from myself. Kind of kept me close enough, you know, that he didn't let me go there. It's like, and I just realized, as I sort of heard myself say it and learned it from myself, if you know what I mean, the Lord is building a church. I don't have to build a church. He's building a church. And if he wants a different roof over it, then that's up to him. That's fine. See, that's the approach to have. But the danger is in the opposite, to get so caught up in our own dreams and our own visions that we don't hear what the Lord says. And the Lord was pretty clear. He took the 12 aside and told them, this is what you can expect. And these two guys at least said, well, forget that. This is what we expect. So don't make that mistake. It's our nature to get all worked up over what seems like a good plan, but we got to learn to keep our ears and our eyes and our hearts open to what the Lord wants to do. Okay, these last five verses, Jesus tells the 12 what he expects. Verse 41. When the 10 heard it, when they heard about James and John and their mom, they began to be greatly displeased with James and John. Did you hear what those two jerks did? What they went they to the Lord and they tried to scoop us on the best seats in the house. I can't believe they did that. I trusted, that kind of ying going on. So what does Jesus do? He calls them, it says, verse 42. He called them, that's the 12 again. He called them to himself, and he said to them, you know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. The first thing Jesus does here is he gives them a new definition of leadership. It's all brought on by this turmoil about them expecting what they expect and wanting what they want. So now he's going to tell them what he expects. And the first thing he does is he gives them this new definition of leadership. And he points out the rulers over the Gentiles. And that would be a reference to the Roman government. Those are the people that ruled over the non-Jews in that part of the world at that time. He says they lord it over them and they exercise authority. Two kinds of worldly leadership. To lord it, that means to hold under subjection. The picture is to have your foot on their neck. You ever seen that? You've heard that expression, probably. I don't know if, hopefully you've never done it or had it done to you. Except sometimes your kids. No, that's a different. But the idea is, I'm bigger and I'm stronger and I'm just going to hold you down. And if you move, it's a very threatening, very unfriendly, uncaring kind of leadership. To lord it over. Then the other one, to exercise authority, means to just wield your power. We might say to boss people around just because you can. You want to put your foot on somebody's neck or just tell them what to do for no other reason other than the fact that you, by virtue of some, freak of nature or accident, you can. I thought of this yesterday. What was I doing? I was surfing around and I came across one of those shows about there are these young people in Hollywood, and I don't know what they're called. I call them idiots. There's lots of them. They're famous for being famous. I mean, they aren't actors, singers, businessmen or women or musicians or, they don't do anything except be famous. That's their job. And there's this one particular young gal, and she was there on her cell phone, and there was something went on in front of her. Somebody got ran over by a car or trampled by the crowd. It was rather than do anything about it or try to help the poor person, she just was giggling and cackling to her friend. Oh, you wouldn't believe it, a guy just got killed. Because, it's just those losers, those, substandard. They aren't rich like me. They aren't celebrities like me. That's the kind of attitude that the Roman government had. That's the kind of attitude that Jesus was talking about. That, I'm going to force you by through threat of violence to do my will. I'm going to boss you around just because I can. It's this heartless, thoughtless, selfish, cruel and mean kind of leadership. He says, that's the way they do it. And they knew. They'd seen it. When Jesus talked about if somebody asks you to walk a mile, walk two. That was a subtle reference to the way a Roman soldier could just, if he was tired of walking, he could ask you, I'll just commandeer that donkey. If he was cold, he could take your coat, literally. If he didn't want to carry what he had to carry, he could sort of inscript any stand, you know, any citizen to carry his load for him. And that's the circumstances they lived in. And Jesus said, you know how that works. You know how it is, how the way those people lord it over and exercise authority over one another. Both of those are selfish abuses of position. In verse 43, he says, yet it shall not be so among you. Now, you know how they do it. I know you know. You've seen it. You've heard it. You've been there. You've done that. But that's not the way it's going to work with you. But whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. See, Jesus' idea of leadership involves being a servant and a slave. Totally goes against the grain of our flesh. Totally goes against our experience in the world. But that's what he expects. In the church, no one puts their foot on another's neck or bosses them around just because they can. Instead, we are to be servants of one another. Now, the same way that he uses two rulers and exercise authority, two ways to refer to the worldly rulers, he uses two words to refer to real leadership in the church. First, he talks about the fact that we are servants of one another. This word servant is diakonos. It may be familiar. It's where we get our English word deacon. A deacon is one who serves others on behalf of the Lord. Remember, where is it? Acts 7, when there was so much going on, the church was going so big that they had to appoint 7 deacons to see to the practical needs, the serving of food. Now, what those deacons were doing is exactly what he's talking about here. On behalf of the Lord, they're meeting the practical needs of the people. He says, that's the greatest in the kingdom are servants of all. You know, on behalf of the Lord, meeting needs. The other word he uses, he says, we're slaves of one another. Now, this is that Greek word doulos. You may be familiar with that. Usually translated bond servant. We talked about this before, so I won't go into it now, but it has absolutely no connection to our American concept of slavery. A doulos, a bond servant, is one who makes themselves a slave voluntarily because they're so devoted to that other one. Devoted to another to the disregard of their own interests. That's what that verse in Exodus is all about. And that great song that we never sing, pierce my ear, O Lord my God, take me to your door this day. It's when a servant so loved and devoted and was so devoted to their master that even though they could have gone free, they chose to stay with that master. And the sign of that would be they'd take him to the doorpost and get an awl and pierce their ear and put an earring in there. And from that day forward, for the rest of their life, everyone who saw them and saw that earring understood that this isn't an indentured servant. This isn't someone working off a debt or somehow being punished. This is one who has given themselves over fully to the will of their owner. So much so that what they want and what they wish isn't part of the discussion. It's not part of the equation anymore. It's all about their willingness to serve that one. That's how Jesus describes leadership in the church. A servant, a deacon, a slave, a doulos, a bond servant. Now, note the contrast. Jesus expects his people to serve one another, not rule over one another. And he expects us to surrender our will in order to accomplish his will. He expects the leaders in his church to have as their primary concern the spiritual well-being and success of those that he puts under our care. Now, you tell that to my friend in Seattle who, when he built a new church, millions and millions and millions of dollars, somehow his own house got remodeled. And I don't know how that happened. You know, the big screen TV, it fell off a truck and we put it up in our living room. And this, and, you know, and the pool out back, well, it was supposed to go at the church. I mean, it's just, you know, it's embarrassing. It's shameful. You know, there was a ministry in Nicaragua that Crossroads supported for years and years and years until finally one year the leadership said, you know what, we're going to go down and visit the ministry and see the fruit that, you know, the investment and all the mission trips. And they went down and everybody was still living in poverty and the church building was about half built. But man, did that guy that they were sending money to have a nice car. And they just went, oh, I can't believe it. There's no servanthood there. There's no bond servant to that way of thinking. The last thing Jesus does here in verse 45, he gives us the heart of the gospel. For even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. You know, note the word even. Even the Son of Man, even him. Think about how we use that word, you know. Even I watch basketball during the playoffs. I don't give a rip about basketball. I don't condemn you one basketball player. But, you know, during the playoffs, even I. You know, there's a comparison there. Even him, see, if anyone is going to be served, if anyone deserves to be served and catered to and kowtowed to, it's going to be the Son of Man. If anyone deserves that, it ought to be Jesus. But he says, even he didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. There's two aspects of that I want to look at. The idea of a ransom. Well, when do you pay a ransom? You know, I've seen the movie of the week. I know what it, you know, somebody gets kidnapped and held for ransom. And then you're supposed to pay the ransom and then they set that one free, right? Or sometimes it's a hostage situation. We see that going on in Iraq more often than we'd like to. They kidnap somebody and they hold them hostage. And if you don't meet our demands, we're going to cut their head off or kill them or whatever it is they're going to do. And that idea of a ransom, you know, being held against your will is the idea. But then there's a payment made, and that payment sets you free. Now, you don't make the payment. Somebody else makes the payment for you. You're held hostage. That ransom is paid on your behalf, and you're set free. And at the end of the verse where he says, to give his life as a ransom for many. The idea there is one for many, to give one life to save many lives. One death to give life to many. That's the heart of the gospel, folks. Jesus didn't come so that my back would stop hurting, although I continue to pray for that daily. He didn't come so I'd be rich, and I don't even pray for that daily. You know? He didn't give his life for a lot of stuff. He didn't give his life to meet my expectations, to make me more comfortable, or even to make me more happy. Now, the fruit of what he did ought to make me happy, but if my expectations are wrong, I'm going to miss all that. He came to be a servant of all and give his life a ransom for many. Is that what you're expecting from the Lord? That his life would pay the ransom to set you free? That his death would give you life? He said, I have come that they might have life and have it abundantly. Not just barely scrape by, kind of tolerate things until we, you know, check out or graduate into the next life. He gave his life, a ransom, to set you and me free. And he gave that one life for many as will receive it, for whosoever will. The key to disappointment is wrong expectations. But if we will listen to the Lord and pay attention to the Lord and align our expectations with His and live our lives according to what He expects of us, disappointment isn't in that dictionary. It's all good, all and only good.